The real Fay and the other one, the brash and aggressive and impulsive Fay. She will long for this other Fay, as the years mount and her days become cluttered with chores, domestic and infantile. She will think about this night so often that it will begin to feel more real to her than her real life. She'll begin to believe that her existence as wife and mother is the illusion, the facade she's projecting to the world. And this Fay, who came alive on the floor of St. Peter's, that's the real one. The authentic self, and this belief will hook so deeply inside her, will pierce her so completely that eventually it will take over. It will become too powerful to ignore, and by then it will not seem like she's abandoning her husband and child. It will seem like she's retrieving the real life she abandoned in Chicago many years ago. She will actually feel good about this, about being true to herself, her real self. It will feel like she's found the one true Fay. At least it will feel like that for a while, until she begins to long for her family, and all the confusion returns. In the story of the blind men and the elephant, what's usually ignored is the fact that each man's description was correct. What Fay won't understand, and may never understand, is that there is not one true self hidden by many false ones. Rather, there is one true self hidden by many other true ones. Yes, she is the meek and shy and industrious student. Yes, she is the panicky and frightened child. Yes, she is the bold and impulsive seductress. Yes, she is the wife, the mother, and many other things as well. Her belief that only one of these is true obscures the larger truth, which was ultimately the problem with the blind men and the elephant. It wasn't that they were blind. It's that they stopped too quickly, and so never knew there was a larger truth to grasp. For Fay, the larger truth, the thing that holds up every important episode in her life like a beam holding up a house, is this. Fay is the one who flees. The one who panics and escapes. Who fled Iowa to avoid disgrace. Who will flee from Chicago and into marriage. Who will flee her family and who will eventually flee the country. And the more she believes she only has one true self, the more she flees to find it. She's like someone trapped in quicksand whose efforts to escape only make her drown faster. Will she ever understand this? Who knows? Seeing ourselves clearly is the project of a lifetime. These thoughts are far away from her now. Now everything is simple. She is a body in congress with another body, and his body is warm and pressing all over into hers, and the taste of his skin is like salt and ammonia. At dawn, she will begin using her head again, but for now it is this simple as taste. She is a body perceiving the world, and all her senses are filled. 35. The only other person in the church who knows what they are doing is Allen Ginsberg, who is sitting cross-legged, leaning against a wall and smiling. He could see them duck behind the altar, could see their candlelit shadows, could hear the familiar jangle of a belt undone. This makes him happy, these kids enjoying their exhausted and soiled flesh. Good for them. It reminds him of that sunflower poem he wrote so long ago. What is it, 10 years, 15, no matter. "Wear not our skin of grime," he had written. "Wear golden sunflowers inside, blessed by our own seed and hairy naked accomplishment bodies growing into mad black formal sunflowers in the sunset." Yes, he thinks, and as he closes his eyes and lets sleep come, he feels satisfied and delighted. For he knows he was right. Part 10. Deleveraging. Late Summer 2011. 1. Once again, Fay had lied to her son. Once again, there was something she felt too ashamed to tell him. In Chicago at the airport, he had asked where she planned to go, and she lied to him. She said she didn't know, that she'd figure it out in London. But in fact, she knew exactly where she was going. As soon as she discovered she'd be traveling alone, she resolved to come here, to Hammerfest, Norway, her father's hometown. The way her father had described it, the family's home in Hammerfest was a resplendent thing. On the edge of town, a wide three-story wooden house with a view out to the ocean. A long pier where the family could fish for an afternoon and come away with a bucket full of Arctic char. A field in front that waved golden with barley through the summer. a small pen for the animals, a few goats, sheep, a horse. The whole spread marked by a line of beautiful blue-green spruces that caught so much snow in winter that the snow sometimes fell off them in great loud thwumps. The house was repainted every spring a bright salmon red after the winter elements dulled the previous year's coat. Faye remembers sitting at her father's feet listening to this and fully internalizing this vision of her family's ancestry, and later adding to it in her mind, putting a jagged mountain range in the background, covering the beaches with the volcanic black sand she saw once in National Geographic. Whatever other beautiful things she encountered in some movie or magazine, any place that seemed to be rural and idyllic and foreign, they all became this place, the home in Hammerfest. It drew together all her fantasies by slow childhood accretion. It became the depository for all the best things, and eventually her image of it was equal parts Nordic and French countryside and Tuscan fields and that great scene in The Sound of Music of singing and spinning in the grassy Bavarian hills. The real Hammerfest, Faye discovers, does not look like this at all. After a quick flight from England to Oslo and another flight into de Havilland that seemed too big for its propellers to keep up, she lands in Hammerfest to find a rocky, hardscrabble place, devoid of any growing thing except the hardiest and prickliest of shrubs and thicket. A place that whistles with the wind of the Arctic Circle, a wind that carries on it a sweet petrochemical vapor. For this is an oil town, a gas town. Fishing boats are dwarfed by massive orange container ships taking liquid natural gas and crude oil to refineries that dot the coastline, to round white storage and distillation tanks that look from the air like mushrooms sprouting from some dead thing. Offshore platforms drilling reservoir gas are visible from town. No fields of gently swaying barley, but rather empty lots with discarded equipment rusted and petrolic. Rocky hills, craggy and covered with lichen. No beaches, but rather a bouldered and inaccessible cliffside that looks like the aftermath of an accident involving dynamite. The houses painted brightly in yellows and oranges are more a bulwark against the dark winter than evidence of actual cheer. How could this be the beautiful place she imagined? It seemed so foreign. She had thought she'd find somebody at the tourist office who could help her, but when she said she was looking for the Anderson farm, they looked at her like she was out of her mind. No Anderson farm, they said. No farms at all, they said. So she described the house, and they said that house wouldn't exist anymore. The Germans would have destroyed it in the war. They destroyed that specific house? They destroyed every house. Faye was given a pamphlet for the Museum of Reconstruction. She said she was looking for a place with a fair bit of land and maybe some spruce trees and a house that faced the water. Might they know where she could find a place like that? They said that could describe a lot of places and told her to walk around. Walk around? Yes, it's not a big city, so that's what she's doing. Faye walks Hammerfest's perimeter looking for something that matches her father's description, a farm at the edge of town with a view of the water. She passes flimsy square apartment buildings that seem huddled together for warmth. No fields whatsoever, no farms. She moves out farther where the terrain is stony, weedy. The only plants able to survive are those that root into the rock itself, hard, crunchy grasses that go dormant during the 2 months of darkness that come during winters above the Arctic Circle. Faye feels like a fool. She's been walking for hours. She had actually thought she knew what to expect here. She had actually believed in her own fantasy all these years, and still she's making the old mistakes. She finds a path of trampled down grass that leads over a nearby ridge, and she follows it, lost in dismal thought, saying out loud at roughly every second step, "Stupid. Stupid." For that's what she is, stupid, and every stupid decision she's ever made has led her here, to this stupid place, alone on a chalk-dusty path at the godforsaken end of the world. "Stupid," she says, staring at her feet, climbing the path that leads steeply uphill and over the ridge ahead, thinking that coming here was stupid, looking for the old house was stupid, even her clothing is stupid, little white flat-soled shoes totally inappropriate for hiking over tundra, and a thin shirt she hugs around herself because even though it is summer, it is brisk. Just a few more stupid choices in a life full of them, she thinks. It was stupid to come here. It was stupid to get back in contact with Samuel, whom she felt responsible for after abandoning him to Henry, which was also stupid. No, that wasn't stupid, but marrying Henry in the first place was stupid, and leaving Chicago was stupid. And on it goes as Faye continues up the hill, tracing back her long line of bad decisions. What had started it? What put her on the path to this stupid life? She doesn't know. When she looks back on it, all she sees is that old familiar desire to be alone. To be free of people and their judgments and their messy entanglements. Because whenever she got tangled up with someone, disaster always followed. She got tangled up with Margaret in high school, only to become a town pariah. And with Alice in college, only to be arrested and plunged into violence and mayhem. And with Henry, only to wreck the child they had together. She had been relieved at the airport when Samuel's name appeared on the no-fly list. She feels bad about this now, but it's true. She felt these opposing emotions, joy that Samuel no longer seemed to hate her, and relief that he wasn't coming with her. For how could she have endured the entire flight to London with him, a whole ocean of questions? Never mind traveling with him and living with him wherever they ended up. He seemed to prefer Jakarta for some reason. His need was too much. It was always too much for her to bear. How could she tell Samuel that she was going to Hammerfest because of a silly ghost story? The one she heard as a child. The story her father told her about the Nissa on the night of her first panic attack. The story had stayed with her all this time, and when Samuel mentioned Alice's name, she was reminded of something her old friend told her long ago. The way to get rid of a ghost is to take it home. Which is stupid. Such superstition. Stupid, stupid, she says. It's as if she really is haunted. All this time she thought maybe her father had brought some curse from the old country, some ghost. Only now she thinks maybe she's not haunted, but rather she's the one doing the haunting. Maybe the curse is her, because every time she's gotten close to someone she has paid for it. And maybe it's appropriate she's now here, in the remotest part of the world, alone. Nobody to get tangled up with. No more lives to destroy. She reaches the top of the ridge, lost in thought, brooding on these bitter things, when she becomes aware of a presence. She looks up to see a horse standing in the path, maybe 20 feet ahead, where the ridge begins sloping back downhill to a small valley. She flinches and exclaims a surprised, "Oh!" when she sees it. But the horse does not seem startled. It is not moving. It is not eating. She does not seem to have interrupted anything. It's eerie, like it's been expecting her. The horse is white and tensely muscled. Its flanks occasionally shiver. Big, round, black eyes that seem to consider her wisely. A bit in its mouth, reins around its neck, no saddle. It stares at her as if it's just asked an important question and is waiting for her to respond. "Hello," she says. The horse is not afraid of her, nor is it friendly. It is simply that Faye occupies its whole attention at the moment. It's actually a little creepy, the way it seems to be waiting for her to do something or say something, though she does not know what. She takes a step toward it, and the horse has no reaction. She takes another step. Still nothing. "Who are you?" she says. And even as she says it, the answer bursts into her head. It's a Nyx. After all these years, it has appeared to her, here, on a ridge high above the frigid harbor in Norway, in the northernmost city in the world. She has found herself in a fairy tale. The horse looks unblinkingly straight at her, as if to say, "I know who you are." And she feels herself drawn to it, wanting to touch it, to rub her hand along its ribs, and bound onto it and let it do whatever it wishes to do. It would be a fitting end, she thinks. She comes closer, and even as she reaches up to pet the beast's face, still it does not flinch. Still it waits. She touches it on that spot between its eyes, that spot she always thinks will be softer than it really is, the skull so close to the surface there, all thin fur and bone. "Were you waiting for me?" she says into its ear, which is gray and black and flecked silver and looks like a porcelain teacup. She wonders if she can leap onto its back, if she can manage the jump. That would be the hardest part. The next part would be simple. If the horse began galloping, it would reach the nearby cliff in maybe a dozen strides. The fall down to the water would take only seconds. It amazes her that after such a long life, the end could come that quickly. Then Faye hears a sound, a voice carried on the wind from the valley below. A woman is down there walking toward her, yelling something in Norwegian, and beyond her, just past her, is a house. A small, square thing with a deck in back that faces the water. A path down to a rickety wooden dock. A big garden out front. A few spruce trees. A small pasture for a couple of goats, a couple of sheep. The house is gray and weathered, but in the places that are protected from the wind, under the eaves and behind window shutters, Faye can see the lingering color of old paint. Salmon red. She almost falls over at the sight. It's not how she imagined it, but still she recognizes it. It's familiar, as if she'd been here many times before. When the woman reaches her, Faye can see she's handsome and young, maybe Samuel's age, with the same striking feature she sees all the time in this country. Fair skin, blue eyes, long straight hair, that delicate color halfway between blonde and cotton. She's smiling and saying something that Faye does not understand. "This must be your horse," Faye says. She feels self-conscious about using English so presumptuously, but she has no alternative. The woman does not seem offended, though. She cocks her head at this new information and seems to process it for a moment, then says, "British?" "American." "Ah," she says, nodding, as if this solves some important mystery. "The horse wanders off sometimes. Thank you for catching him." "I didn't really catch him. He was standing here when I found him. It's more like he caught me." The woman introduces herself. Her name is Lillian. She's wearing gray herringbone pants of some sturdy-looking material, a light blue sweater, a wool scarf that looks homemade. She's the very picture of unassuming Nordic style, restrained and elegant. Certain women can wear a scarf effortlessly. Lillian takes the horse by the reins, and together they all begin walking back down toward the house. Faye wonders if this might be a distant relative, a cousin, for this is almost certainly the place. So many of the details match, even if the version her father told was exaggerated. Not a field in the front yard, but rather a garden. Not a long line of spruces, but only two. Not a great pier over the water, but instead a small, flimsy-looking dock, perhaps large enough for a canoe. Faye wonders whether he was self-consciously lying and puffing it up, or if, in the years since he left, in his imagination, the house really did grow in its proportions and majesty. Lillian, meanwhile, is pleasantly making conversation, asking Faye where she's from, how she's enjoying her travels, where she's gone. She suggests restaurants to try, nearby sights to see. "This is your house?"
"It's my mother's."
"Does she live here, too?"
"Of course."
"How long has she lived here?"
"Most of her life."
The garden out front is wild with life, a great efflorescence of bushes and grasses and flowers thick and barely domesticated. It's an eccentric and rowdy garden, a place where nature has been encouraged to its messy ends. Lillian leads the horse into its pen and closes a rickety gate that she secures with a bit of twine tied in a knot. She thanks Faye for helping return the animal.
"I hope you enjoy your vacation," she says.
And even though this is what Faye has come here to find, she's feeling tongue-tied and nervous now, not sure exactly what to say or how to proceed, not sure how to explain everything.
"Listen, I'm not really on vacation."
"Oh?"
"I'm looking for someone. Old family, actually, relatives of mine."
"What's the name? Maybe I can help."
Faye swallows. She doesn't know why she's so anxious saying it.
"Anderson."
"Anderson," Lillian says.
"That's a pretty common name."
"Yes, but you see, I think this is it. What I mean is, I think my family used to live here, in this house.
Nobody in our family was named Anderson or moved to America. Are you sure you have the right town?"
"My father is Frank Anderson. When he lived here, he went by Fritjof."
"Fritjof,"
Lillian says. And this seems to take a moment to register as she looks up in concentration, trying to access why that name sounds familiar. But then suddenly she finds it and she looks at Faye and her stare feels piercing.
"You know Fritjof?"
"I'm his daughter."
"Oh my," she says, and she grabs Faye by the wrist. "Come this way."
She leads Faye into the house, first through a pantry full of vegetables elaborately canned and pickled and labeled, through a warm kitchen where some bready thing is baking, the air smelling of yeast and cardamom, and into a small living room with squeaky wood floors and wood furniture that seems antique and handmade.
Wait here,
says Lillian, who lets go of Faye's wrist and disappears through another door. The room she's left in is cozy and richly decorated with blankets and pillows and photographs on the walls, presumably family photos which Faye studies. None of the people here look familiar, except for certain of the men who have a quality around the eyes that Faye recognizes from her father. Or maybe she's imagining it? A familiar kind of squint, a familiar way with the eyebrow, the slight wrinkle between the eyes. There are lamps and chandeliers and candles and sconces all over, presumably to light the place brilliantly during the interminable winter darkness. A big stone fireplace occupies one wall. Another wall is filled with books with unassuming white spines and titles Faye does not recognize. A laptop computer that seems anachronistic in the otherwise old-fashioned room. Faye can hear Lillian speaking through the door, speaking gently but quickly. Faye does not know a single word of Norwegian, so the language is only a phonic event for her, its vowels sounding a little flat, almost like German spoken in a minor key. Like most languages that are not American English, it seems to move too fast. Soon the door opens and Lillian returns, followed by her mother. And when Faye sees her, it's like she's looking into a mirror. In the eyes and the way they both hunch at the shoulders, and the way age is played out on both their faces. The woman recognizes it too, and she comes to an abrupt stop when she sees Faye. And they stare at each other for a moment, not moving. It would be clear to anyone watching that they're sisters. Faye can see her father's features play out on the woman's face, his cheekbones, his eyes, his nose. The woman cocks her head suspicious. She has an unruly mass of gray hair tied up at the top by a ribbon. She's wearing a plain black shirt and old blue jeans, both dotted with the evidence of many domestic chores, paint and spackle, and on the jeans, on the knees, mud. She is barefoot. She's wiping her hands clean with a dark blue rag. "I am Freya," she says. And Faye's heart leaps. Every ghost story her father told her, everyone involving a beautiful young girl, this was the name he gave her. Freya. "I'm sorry to bother you," Faye says.
"You are Fritjof's daughter?"
"Yes, Fritjof Andersen."
"You're from America?"
"Chicago."
"So,"
she says to nobody in particular, "he went to America." Then she gestures toward Lillian.
"Show her."
And Lillian fetches a book from a shelf and sits on the couch. The book is an antique, yellowed, brittle pages, two flaps of leather protecting its cover, a clasp on the front. Faye has seen one of these before, her father's Bible, the one with the family tree on the inside, filled with exotic names he used to show her, and clucked disapprovingly at because they were all too cowardly to make a better life for themselves in America. And the Bible in Lillian's lap is just the same sort, a family tree on the front two pages. But whereas her father stopped at Faye, this one shows the full blooming of the family here in Hammerfest. Lillian, Faye can see, is one of Freya's six children. Grandchildren fill the next line down, a few great-grandchildren below that. It's a flourishing that takes another sheet of paper to fully accommodate. And above Freya's name are her parents' names. Martha, her mother, and another name, blacked out, inked over. Freya shuffles toward them and stands in front of Faye and bends to point at that spot. "This was Fritjof," she says, her fingernail pressing a crescent into the page.
"He's your father, too."
"Yes." "His name is erased."
"My mother did that."
"Why?"
"Because he was, how do you say it?"
She looked at Lillian for help with the words. She says something in Norwegian, and Lillian nods in comprehension and says,
"Oh, you mean coward?"
"Yes," Freya says.
"He was a coward."
And she watches Faye, waiting to see what kind of reaction this will bring, whether Faye will be offended by this. And Freya is tense and maybe waiting for an argument she seems perfectly willing to have.
"I don't understand," says Faye. "A coward. Why?" "Because he left. He abandoned us."
"No, he immigrated," Faye says. "He tried to make a better life for himself."
"For himself, yes.
He never mentioned he had family here."
"Then you don't know very much about him."
"Will you tell me?"
Freya breathes heavily and looks at Faye with what feels like impatience or disdain.
Is he still alive?
Yes, but his mind is going. He's very old.
What did he do in America?
He worked at a factory, a chemical factory.
And did he have a good life?
Faye thinks about this for a moment, about all those times she saw her father alone, keeping his distance from others, desolate, in his own self-made prison, standing for hours in the backyard, staring into the sky.
No, she says. He always seemed sad and lonely. We never knew why.
Freya seems to soften at this. She nods. She says,
"Stay for dinner, then. I'll tell you the story."
And she does, over bread and a fish stew. It's the story Freya's mother told her when Freya was old enough to understand it. It begins in 1940, the last time anyone heard anything about Fritjof Andersen. Like most young men in Hammerfest, he was a fisherman. He was 17 and had recently graduated from the dockside work given to children, the cleaning and gutting and filleting. He now worked on the boat, which was an all-around better job. More lucrative, more fun. So much more thrilling when they drag up whole big nets of cod and halibut and the evil-looking, foul-smelling wolf fish, which everyone universally agreed was better to catch than to gut. Whole days spent out on the water, losing track of the days because in the summer in the Arctic the sun never sets, and feeling proud of the mastery he achieved with his trade's various tools, the buoys and nets and kegs and lines and hooks stored in the hull just so. His favorite thing was sitting lookout atop the highest mast because he had the sharpest eyes on the boat. He had a gift, everyone said so. He spotted the schools of blackfish that steered into the bay all summer long. And seeing a boiling spot on the water, he yelled, "Fish-o!" And all the men would roll out of bed and put on their caps and get to work. They'd lower the rowboats, two men per craft, one to handle the oars, the other the net. And they'd spread the net between them, and he'd direct the whole operation from up top, until the school reached them, and they'd encircle the fish and hoist the whole churning mass of them triumphantly into the boat. There was power in that, their control over the wild sea, feeling unstoppable even while they sailed too close to jagged shores that would doom their ship to sinking if they weren't such capable sailors. Fritjof could spot the fish better than anyone in living memory. He had the sharpest eyes in town, and he bragged about this constantly, whenever they were in port. He said the ocean was a piece of paper only he could read. He was young, he had a bit of money, he spent time in bars. He met a waitress named Marta. It might not be accurate to say he fell in love with her, more like they were both feeling certain common teenage longings, and they made themselves available to satisfy them. The first time they made love, it was in the hills near her family's house, after he'd waited for the bar to close and walked her home, and they lay in the tough grass under a gray-white sun. Then she showed him around the land, the big house painted salmon red, the long pier over the water, the long line of spruce trees, the field of barley. She loved it here, she said. She was a charming girl. That was the summer the war came. Everyone thought Hammerfest was too remote to be of any concern, but it turned out the Germans wanted the city to disrupt Allied shipping to Russia, plus it would serve as an effective resupply base for their U-boats. The Wehrmacht was coming, was the word that spread up Norway's coast, from dock to dock, boat to boat. There was talk on Fritjof's ship of escape. They could make it to Iceland, start a new life there, or keep going. There were ways to get from Reykjavik to America, some said. But what about the submarines? They wouldn't bother their little fishing boat. But what about the mines? Fritjof would spot them, they said. It could be done. Fritjof wanted to believe what some of the older men said, that the Germans were more interested in the docks than in the city, that they would leave everyone alone as long as there wasn't a resistance, that their fight was with Russia and Britain, not Norway. But rumors had been spreading about happenings in the south. Surprise attacks, burned villages. Fritjof didn't know what to think. On their next landing in Hammerfest, the crew would make a decision, stay or go. Anyone who wanted to stay was free to do so. Anyone wanting to risk the voyage to Iceland would bring all the supplies he could manage. The only one who didn't have a choice was Fritjof. Or at least that's how it seemed to him. When the older guys took him aside and said they needed his eyes, only he could spot the mines that made the waters out beyond the island so treacherous. Only he could read the swirls and eddies that signaled the presence of a U-boat. Only he could see the shapes of enemy ships way out there on the horizon, far enough away to avoid them. He had a gift, they all agreed. They'd be dead without him. That night he waited for the bar to close and went to see Marta. She was so happy to see him. They made love in the grass again, and afterward she told him she was pregnant.
"We'll have to get married, of course," she said.
"Of course."
"My parents say you can live with us. We'll inherit the house someday."
"Yes." "Good."
"My grandmother thinks it's a girl. She's usually right about these things. I want to name her Freya."
They made plans for most of the night. In the morning he told her he was voyaging out to hunt cod to the northeast. He told her he'd be back in a week. She smiled. She kissed him goodbye. And she never saw him again. When Freya was born, she was born to an occupied city. The Germans had come and removed most families from their homes. Soldiers lived in the houses now, while everyone else crowded into apartment buildings or schools or the church. Marta shared a single flat with 16 other families. Some of Freya's earliest memories were from this time of hunger and desperation. They lived this way for 4 years before the Germans withdrew. On that day in the winter of 1944, every living soul in Hammerfest was ordered to evacuate the city. Those who did fled to the forest. Those who didn't were killed. The Germans burned the city to the ground, every structure except the church. When the people returned, there was nothing left to return to but rock and rubble and ash. They lived through that winter in the hills and caves. Freya remembers the cold and the smoke from the fires they burned, smoke that kept everyone awake, coughing and hacking. She remembers vomiting spoonfuls of acid and ash into her hand. In the spring, they emerged from shelter and began rebuilding Hammerfest, but they did not have the resources to make it what it once was. That's why the city looks in places the way it looks now, cheap and anonymous, a testament not to beauty but to resilience. Marta's family rebuilt their house as best they could, even painting it the same color, that same salmon red, and eventually, when Freya was old enough, Marta told her the story of Fridtjof Andersen, her father. Nobody had ever heard from him after the war. They assumed he fled to Sweden, like so many others did. Sometimes Freya would go out to watch the fishing boats, imagining him on top of one searching the ocean for her. She'd daydream about his return, but then the years went by and she grew up and had her own family, and she stopped wishing for his return and started hating him, then stopped hating him and began simply forgetting him. Before Faye arrived, she hadn't thought about her father in years.
"I don't think my mother ever forgave him," Freya said. "She was unhappy most of her life, angry with him, or with herself. She's dead now."
It's just past 7 o'clock and the sunlight pouring into the kitchen is slanted in gold. Freya slaps her palms on the table and stands up.
"Let's go to the water," she says, "for sunset."
She brings Faye a coat and on the walk down explains that sunsets are a precious thing in Hammerfest because they get so few of them. Tonight the sun sets at 8:15. A month ago it was setting at midnight. In another month it will get dark at 5:30. And one day in mid-November the sun will rise at around 11 o'clock in the morning, set about half an hour later, and that's the last they'll see of it for 2 whole months.
2 months of darkness, Faye says. "How do you bear it?" "You get used to it," she says. "What choice do you have?"
They sit on the dock in silence, drinking coffee and feeling a cold breeze coming off the water and watching a copper-colored sun set over the Norwegian sea. Faye tries to imagine her father sitting high above the water, perched on the uppermost mast of a fishing boat, the wind reddening his face. What it must have been like for him in comparison at the ChemStar factory in Iowa, turning dials, recording numbers, doing paperwork, standing on the flat, dull earth. And what would he have been thinking as they left for Iceland, as he watched Hammerfest recede from view, leaving behind a home, a child? How long would he regret it? How big would that regret become? Faye suspects he regretted it forever. That the regret became his secret heart, the thing he buried most deeply. She remembers him as he was when he thought no one was looking, staring off into the distance.
Faye always wondered what he was seeing in those moments, and now she thinks she knows. He was seeing this place, these people. He was wondering what might have been had he made a different decision. It was impossible to ignore the similarity of their names, Freya and Faye. When he named her Faye, was he thinking about the other daughter? When he spoke Faye's name, did he always hear the echo of this other name? Was Faye just a reminder of the family he left behind? Was he trying to punish himself? When he described the home in Hammerfest, he described it as though he'd actually lived there, described it as though it were his, and maybe, in his mind, it was. Maybe next to the actual world was this fantasy, this other life where he inherited the farm with the salmon-red house. Sometimes, those fantasies can be more persuasive than one's own life, Faye knows. Something does not have to happen for it to feel real. Her father was never more animated, never happier, than when he spoke about this place. And maybe even as a child, Faye recognized this. She understood that part of her father was always somewhere else, that when he looked at her, he never really saw her. And she wonders now if all her panic attacks and problems had been elaborate attempts to be paid attention to be seen. She'd convinced herself she was haunted by ghosts from the old country because, even though she didn't understand it in these terms, maybe she was trying to be Freya for him. "Do you have children?" Freya asks, breaking the long silence. "A son." "Are you close?" "Yes," Faye says. Because once again she's too embarrassed to tell the truth. How could she ever tell this woman that she did to her son what Fridtjof did to her? "We're very close," she says.
"Good, good."
Faye thinks about Samuel and seeing him in the airport a few days ago, saying goodbye to him. She had found herself at that moment overcome with a peculiar need to press herself into him, to feel him physically there. It turned out the thing she missed the most was his heat. Those long years after she left the family, what she longed for more than anything was that human warmth. How Samuel would climb into bed on those mornings when another of his nightmares terrified him, or how he'd press into her when he was running a fever. Whenever his need was great, he'd come to her, this little cauldron, this hot, humid ball. She'd press her face into him and smell his little boy's smell, like sweat and syrup and grass. He ran so hot her skin would dampen where it touched him, and she imagined his core burning with all the energy his body would need for its growth to manhood. It was that warmth she craved suddenly in the airport. She has not felt such a thing in a very long time. Mostly she's chilled, maybe because of the pills, her anxiety drugs, her blood thinners and beta blockers. She's always so cold these days. The sun is down now and they're staring at a purple sky. Lillian is in the house lighting a fire. Freya sits listening to the rushing water. To their right up the coast is an island where in the gathering darkness Faye can see a bright tongue of light. "What is that?" she says, pointing.
"Melkea,"
Freya says. "It's a factory. It's where they take the gas." "And that light?"
"Fire. It burns all the time. I don't know why."
And Faye stares at the smokestack venting its orange flame into the night. And all at once she's transported back to Iowa. She's sitting with Henry on the shore of the Mississippi River. And she's looking at the fire coming out of the nitrogen plant. She could see that fire from anywhere in town. She used to call it the lighthouse. That was so long ago it feels like a different life. And at the sudden recall of this long dormant memory, Faye begins to cry. Not a hard cry, but a light and delicate one. She thinks about what Samuel would have called it, this crying, a category one, and she smiles. Freya either does not notice the crying or pretends not to notice it. "I'm sorry I got him and you didn't," Faye says. "Our father, I mean. I'm sorry he left you. It's not fair." Freya waves at her, dismissing it. "We managed. I know he missed you a great deal."
"Thank you."
"I think he always wanted to come back. I think he regretted leaving." Freya stands and looks out at the water.
It's good he stayed away.
Why?
Look around you, she says, opening her arms to the house, the land, the animals. To Lillian and the fire she's building, and the Bible with its exhausting family tree. We didn't need him.
She extends her hand to Faye and they shake, a formal gesture declaring the end of this conversation, and the end of Faye's visit.
It was very nice to meet you, Frey says.
And you.
I hope you have a nice stay.
I will. Thank you for your hospitality.
Lillian will drive you to your hotel.
It's not far. I can walk.
Freya nods and begins making her way toward the house, but then a few steps up the path she stops and turns to Faye and looks at her with these knowing eyes that seem to pass straight through her and access every secret she has inside.
These old stories aren't important anymore, Faye. Go back to your son.
And all Faye can do is nod her head in agreement and watch as Freya ascends the rest of the way and disappears into the house. Faye lingers a moment on the dock before leaving as well. She follows a path up the ridge, and when she reaches the top at precisely the place she met the horse, she looks back down into the valley at the house, now lit warm and golden, a thin tendril of blue smoke drifting from the chimney. Maybe this is where her father stood. Maybe this is what he remembered. Maybe this is the vision that passed before his eyes those nights in Iowa, when he stared into nothingness. It would be a memory that sustained him his whole life, but it would also be the thing that haunted him. And that old story about the ghost that looks like a rock comes to her now. The farther from shore you take it, the heavier it becomes, until one day it gets too heavy to bear. Faye imagines her father taking a small piece of earth with him, a memento, this farm, this family, his memory of it. This was the drowning stone from his stories. He took it to sea and took it to Iceland and took it all the way to America. And as long as he held on to it, he just kept sinking.
2.
Why have hospital rooms begun to look like hotel rooms? Is something Samuel wonders as he looks around this hospital room's beige walls and beige ceiling and beige curtains and industrially sturdy carpet whose color could be described as tan or wheat or beige. Paintings on the walls designed to be inoffensive and forgettable and unupsetting and so abstract they do not remind anyone of anything. Television with a billion channels, including free HBO, according to the little cardboard sign on the dresser. A fake oak dresser with a Bible inside. The desk in the corner with the many ports and outlets is the wireless workstation, with a Wi-Fi password printed on laminated paper and crinkled and splitting at the edges. A room service menu where you can order things like chicken fried steaks and French fries and milkshakes and have them delivered anywhere in the building, even the cardiac wing. The remote control velcroed to the television. The television bolted to the wall and angled toward the bed so that it's like the television is watching the patient, not the other way around. A book of nearby Chicago attractions. The couch along the far wall is actually a hide-a-bed, which is something anyone will realize if they sit on it too quickly and bang into its hard metal architecture. A digital clock radio with green numbers currently blinking midnight. A doctor in the room, thoroughly bald, explaining the case to a group of medical students. Patient's name unknown, he says. An alias he goes by is, Pwnage? The doctor looks to Samuel for help. Pwnage, Samuel says. Two syllables, rhymes with onage, but with a P. What's onage? Says one of the students. Did he say orange? I think he said porridge. The doctor tells the students they are lucky to be here today because they may never see a case quite like this again. And indeed, the doctor is considering writing an article about this patient in the Journal of Medical Oddities, which the students would be invited to co-author, of course. The students look at Pwnage with the same bemused appreciation they might have for a bartender preparing them an elaborate drink for free. Pwnage has been sleeping for 3 days straight. Not in a coma, the doctor has pointed out. Sleeping. The hospital is nourishing him intravenously, and Samuel has to admit that Ponage looks better, his skin less waxy, his face less bulbous, the splotchy rashes all over his neck and arms now faded to more or less normal human textures. Even his hair seems healthier, more, and this is the only way Samuel could think of describing it, well-attached. The doctor is listing the various medical conditions the patient presented upon admission to the emergency room. Malnutrition, exhaustion, malignant hypertension, kidney and liver malfunction, dehydration so far along that frankly I'm not sure how the patient wasn't hallucinating more or less all the time about water. The students write this down. The doctor's head and face and arms have achieved a really impressive shark-like hairlessness. The medical students carry clipboards and they collectively smell like antiseptic soap and cigarettes. A heartbeat monitor connected to Ponage by a series of wires and suction cups is not beeping. Samuel stands with Axeman and keeps looking at him with these quick sidelong glances that he hopes Axeman won't notice. Samuel has heard Axeman speaking over the computer hundreds of times from their many raids together, but has never met him in person, and he's feeling that dislocation you feel when the visual does not match up with the oral, like when you see a radio personality's face for the first time and you think, really? Axeman's voice has that whiny, nasally quality that makes him seem online like he must be one of those 90-pound, bepimpled, nearsighted sissies who are the very quintessence of the online gamer stereotype. His reedy voice is the phonic equivalent of a punch that does not hurt, the kind of voice that makes it sound like his mouth was stuffed into a sinus cavity a long time ago by bullies. And cardiac arrhythmia, the doctor is saying, diabetic ketoacidosis, diabetes, which he probably didn't even know he had, and which he definitely was not managing in any way, and which made his blood about the same thickness and consistency as instant pudding. The real-life Axeman turns out to be stylish and dashing. His tight shorts and tank top combo, and his tanned arms that are muscular but not gaudily so, and his sockless boat shoes, and his moderately curly hair begging to be playfully tousled, it all seems like he dressed from some instruction manual given only to young, hip, gay men. Pretty soon he's going to discover sex, and then he'll wonder why he ever spent so much time playing video games.
So we were all there, Axeman is saying, on the cliffs above Mistwater Cape. You know the place?
Samuel nods. It's a spot on the Elfscape map, the southernmost point of the western continent, the place Ponage apparently had his near-terminal medical crisis. That's where Axeman found him, his avatar, naked and dead, and he noticed Ponage's prolonged AFK status, which stands for away from keyboard, which Ponage almost never was, Axeman knew, away from his keyboard. So Axeman called the real-life authorities who went to investigate and saw through the front windows Ponage slumped unconscious before his computer.
I told everyone to meet at Mistwater,
Axeman says in a semi-whisper so as not to interrupt the doctor.
I posted it online, candlelight vigil for Ponage. We had a pretty good turnout, maybe 30 people. All elves, of course.
Of course, Samuel says. He has the feeling one of the attractive female medical students is right now eavesdropping on their conversation, and he feels that embarrassment he feels whenever someone from the real world discovers this is what he does with his spare time. Plays Elfscape.
All these elves standing there with our lit candles, except for one guy in the back who was breakdancing and not really taking part. It was a somber and beautiful and mournful scene.
And a rash on his arm that looked alarmingly similar to, but thankfully was not, necrotizing fasciitis, says the doctor.
The dome of his bare head shines. It makes the room feel bigger in the same way a large mirror might.
But so here's the thing,
Axeman says, and he's now gripping Samuel's shirt and pulling lightly at it to keep Samuel's attention and to express his own agitation.
I posted plans for the vigil online, in the Elves Only forum, but it turns out there were some trolls who saw it too.
Trolls?
Yeah, orcs.
Wait, trolls or orcs?
Orcs who were trolling, you know what I mean? Some orc-playing players saw the news about the candlelight vigil and reposted it in the Orcs Only forum, which of course I didn't see because I don't read their forums because I'm honorable like that.
The reason the heartbeat monitor is not beeping is because heartbeat monitors in real life do not beep, Samuel decides. That must be a Hollywood affectation, a way to report to the audience what's going on inside the patient's chest. The heartbeat monitor attached to Ponage just slowly prints a jagged line onto a narrow piece of paper that's spooled up like something inside a cash register.
So unbeknownst to us, Axeman says, While we're gathering on the cliffs above Mistwater Cape, the orcs are hiding in a cave to the north. And right in the middle of our ceremony, which I should stress was, with the exception of the guy who was breakdancing and then later took off all his clothes and jumped around a lot, really somber and beautiful and quiet, right in the middle, right as I'm making a speech about what a great guy Ponage is, and how we're all hoping he gets better soon, and urging people to write get-well cards to him, and giving out the address of the hospital so that they can write actual, real paper cards, all of a sudden, all these orcs rush out of the trees and start murdering us.
The attractive medical student seems to be chewing on her pencil, either to suppress the smile or outright giggle generated by eavesdropping on this particular conversation. Or because she's a smoker, and that's one of those oral fixation unconscious tick things that smokers tend to do. The doctor's head has the buffed quality of a new bowling ball still wrapped in its protective sheath.
So all of our orc alarms start going off and we all turn around to fight them,
says Axeman.
Only we can't fight them. Do you know why we can't fight them?
Because you're all holding candles?
Because we're all holding candles.
That the doctor does not even have eyebrows or eyelashes is an unsettling quality it takes Samuel a few minutes to identify. Before that, it was like the guy looked off for a reason he couldn't quite put his finger on.
So this orc starts fighting me,
Axeman says.
And I instinctively swing at him and hit him, but of course I hit him with a candle, which does like zero damage and causes him to ROFL over and over. So I open my control panel and select the character screen and select the candle, and then locate my sword in my inventory screen, and then double-click to switch them, and the game says, "Are you sure you want to trade items?" And all this time the orc is chopping me in half slowly with his axe, swinging away casually, and I'm just standing there like a tree, totally helpless to stop him. And I'm all like to the game, "Yes, I want to trade items! Yes, I'm fucking sure!"
At Axeman's sudden outburst, the doctor and the students look over with these expressions of disdain that communicate how quickly he'd be thrown out of here had he not saved the life of the patient they're going to write a quirky journal article about.
"So anyway," says Axeman, quieter now, "I ultimately don't have time to even switch weapons because I'm fully dead way before I get through the process. And so my ghost resurrects at the nearest graveyard, and I run the ghost back to my body and respawn, and you know what happens?
The orcs are still there."
"The orcs are still there, and I'm still holding a goddamn candle."
"And lactic acidosis," says the doctor, stronger now, trying to talk over Axeman. "And hyperthyroidism, urinary retention, croup." The doctor's all-over hairlessness is beginning to seem clinical and not aesthetic, like he suffers from a genetic disorder the kids probably made fun of throughout his childhood, which makes Samuel feel a little guilty for staring.
"And this happens maybe 20 or 30 times,
says Axeman.
"I get back to my body, respawn, and get killed within seconds. Rinse and repeat. I wait for the orcs to get tired of it, but they never do. I finally get so angry I log out and post a pretty big rant on the Orcs Only forum, where I say the behavior of the orcs who crashed our vigil was reprehensible and immoral. I said all their accounts should be banned and they should personally apologize to everyone in our guild. This ignited a pretty big debate."
"What's the consensus?"
"The orcs said their maneuver was accurately orc-like. They said killing us during our vigil was in keeping with how orcs are supposed to act in the game world. I said sometimes the game world and the real world overlap in certain places, where the real world should take precedence, like during a quiet vigil where friends are mourning for their seriously ill raid leader buddy. They said their orc avatars don't know what this real world is that I'm talking about, and for them, the Elfscape world is the only world that exists. I said if that's true, then they would never have known about the vigil in the first place because they don't have orc laptops from which to access the elves-only online forums. And even if they did, they could not comprehend what was written there because orcs cannot read English."
This all sounds very complicated.
"It opened up this big metaphysical problem about how much of the real world you're bracketing when you're playing Elfscape. Most of our guild is taking the week off from raiding to think about the problem."
"Did you ever log on again?"
"Not yet. My elf is still on that cliff, dismembered."
The doctor is saying, "I swear to God this is the first time I've ever seen a pulmonary embolism be the least bad thing wrong with someone. Compared to everything else going on here, the anticoagulant we administered for the embolism was an easy fix." Samuel feels the little buzzing of his phone in his pocket that signals a new email. He sees it's from his mother. Despite their agreement, she has written. He excuses himself and goes into the hallway to read it.
"Samuel, I know we said I shouldn't do this, but I've had a change of heart. If the police ask, please tell them the truth. I didn't stay in London. I didn't go to Jakarta. I went to Hammerfest. It's in Norway, the northernmost city in the world. It's terribly remote and sparsely populated. You'd think it would suit me. I'm telling you this because I've decided not to stay. I've met some people who have convinced me to come home. I'll explain later. Actually, Hammerfest is no longer the northernmost city in the world, I just discovered. Technically, it is the second northernmost. There's a place called Honningsvåg that is also in Norway and slightly farther north that declared itself a city a few years back. But with a population of about 3,000 people, you can hardly call it a city, so the debate rages on. Most folks in Hammerfest are friendly to anyone except people from Honningsvåg, whom they consider usurpers and bastards. The things you learn, eh? At any rate, Hammerfest is distant and isolated. It'll take me a few days to get home. In the meantime, I want you to go find your friend Periwinkle. Tell him to tell you the truth. You deserve some answers. Tell him I said to tell you everything. He and I go way back, you should know. We met in college. I used to be in love with him. If you want proof, go back to my apartment. On the shelf, there's a thick book of poetry, The Collected Ginsberg. I want you to look inside that book. You'll find a photograph. I hid it in there years ago. Please don't be angry with me when you find it. Soon you'll have all the answers you want, and when you do, remember that all I was trying to do was help. I did it clumsily, but I did it for you. Love, Faye. Samuel thanks Axeman and tells him to send word once Pwnage wakes up. He leaves the hospital and drives quickly into Chicago. He enters his mother's apartment through the still-wrecked door. He finds the book and begins flipping through it, holding it upside down and shaking it. It has that old book smell, dry and musty. The pages are yellowed and feel brittle on his fingertips. A photograph flutters out and lands on the floor face down. On the back it is signed, "To Faye, on your honeymoon. Love, Al." Samuel picks it up. It is the same photograph he'd seen on the news, the one taken at that protest in 1968. There is his mother in her big round glasses. There is Alice sitting behind her, all deadly serious. But this photograph is larger than the one he'd seen on the news. Its field of vision wider. He realizes that the photo he thought he knew so well was actually only a fragment from this bigger photo, sectioned off, cropped to hide the man his mother leans against. But Samuel can see him now. This man. His bowl of black hair. The way he looks sidelong and cleverly at the camera. His eyes full of mischief. He is so young and his face is half in shadow. But it's obvious. Samuel has seen that face before. It's the spitting image of Guy Periwinkle. 3. Guy Periwinkle's office in downtown Manhattan is on the 20th floor, southeast corner, overlooking the financial district. Two whole walls are made entirely of glass. The other walls are painted a neutral slate gray. A small desk in the middle of the room, a single swivel chair. There are no works of art on the walls, no family photos, no statuary or plants. Nothing on the desk but a single sheet of paper. The aesthetic here is way beyond minimalism, more like monkish denial. The only decoration in the entire large space is a single-framed advertisement for some kind of new potato chip thing. The new chip is shaped like a small torpedo instead of the more traditional triangle or circle. The ad is dominated by a photograph of a man and a woman whose bug-eyed excitement to eat these chips might best be described as maniacal. A caption above them, written in bold, three-dimensional-looking letters, says, "Do you need to liven up your snack routine?" This advertisement is roughly the size of a movie poster. It looks out of place in its lavish gold frame. Samuel has been waiting for 20 minutes, walking around the room like a bean jumping in its pod from window to advertisement and back, studying each thing for as long as he can before his agitation twists him up and he feels it necessary to pace. He left for New York directly from his mother's apartment. It is the second time in his life he's driven from Chicago to New York City, and the feeling of déjà vu is so powerful right now that he's feeling this low-level background dread. The last time he drove to New York, it did not turn out well. And it's impossible not to remember this right now because as he stares out Periwinkle's office window, he can see, a few blocks to the east, that old familiar building, the thin white one with the gargoyles near the top, the building at 55 Liberty Street. Bethany's building.
He stares at the building and wonders if she's there right now, maybe looking this way, in Samuel's direction at all the ruckus below. For between Bethany's building and Periwinkle's, way down at street level, is Zuccotti Park. Though park is a generous term for this small patch of concrete no larger than a few tennis courts, where protesters have been gathered for weeks. Samuel had waded through the crowd on his way into the building. "We are the 99%, their sign said. This space occupied." From above, he can see the great mass of people, the fluorescent blue nylon bubbles of their tents, the drum circle on the outer edge, which is all he can hear of the protests from up here on the 20th floor, the endless, unstoppable drumming. He moves back to the advertisement. The new torpedo-shaped potato chips seem to come in their own special plastic serving cups with peel-away tops like yogurt. The way the couple stares at the chips in anticipation of eating them is so manic that it almost looks like terror. The door opens and Periwinkle finally appears. He wears his usual tight gray suit and colorful tie, turquoise today. His hair is newly dyed and looks lacquered black. He sees Samuel looking at the potato chip poster and says, "That advertisement tells you everything you need to know about 21st century America." He swings himself into the desk chair and swivels it around until he faces Samuel. "Everything I need to know to do my job is right there," he says, pointing at it. "If you can understand this ad's insight, then you can conquer the world." "It's a stupid potato chip," Samuel says. "Of course it's a stupid potato chip. It's that phrase I love. Snack routine." Outside, the drumming swells and then dissipates by some improvisational musical logic. "I guess I'm missing it," Samuel says, the genius. "Think about it. Why does one eat a snack? Why is a snack necessary?" "The answer, and we've done a million studies on this, is because our lives are filled with tedium and drudgery and endless toil, and we need a tiny blip of pleasure to repel the gathering darkness. Thus, we give ourselves a treat." "But here's the thing.